Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9 a.m. February 12th, 2021. With me today is Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Bishop, myself, Stedman. We have Senator Hoffman online, and Senator Von Imhoff is in other meetings. Today we have one item on the agenda. We're going to go over the oil and gas production tax, what we refer to as the order of operation, kind of a reminder and a refresher, as we have one of the most, literally, one of the most complex oil tax structures on the planet. And some of us feel it's overly complex and leads to difficulties and unknown results given certain circumstances. So we have asked the chief economist from the Department of Revenue, Mr. Dan Stickle, if he would be so kind as to walk us through the order of operations, kind of how the system works. We have, as just a reminder for those watching, we have numerous corporations and subchapter S companies in our oil basins, but mainly today we're going to talk about north of 68, which is the North Slope. We have all their individual corporate data solidified into one unit, like we would appear we only have one company. And that's what we have to work with here. So it makes it difficult in numerous areas to put a fine point on the policy, because each company is different and all we see is consolidated data, and they are not all equal in ownership or corporate structure or profitability. So we have some handicaps we have to deal with. So Mr. Stickle, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through your presentation, please.
Sure. My name is Dan Stickle. I'm chief economist with the Alaska Department of Revenue. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that introduction. And thank you for the opportunity to present our production tax order of operations presentation today. The purpose of the presentation is to present a high-level overview of how Alaska's oil and gas production tax works for the North Slope. As you mentioned, the discussion is probably more of a refresher for most of you on the committee, but we hope that it also helps viewers who are less familiar with oil taxes to better understand the current system. So looking at slide two, Senate Finance has asked us in the past to spell out any acronyms. So here's a list of some of the acronyms used in the presentation. The oil and gas industry and state budgets and taxes have a lot of jargon and acronyms, and we try to minimize those as much as possible, but some of those are unavoidable. So we included this slide for the record and as a reference for folks as we're going through the presentation. Moving on to slide three, the purpose of the presentation, again, is to explain the nuts and bolts of the production tax and fiscal system, what we have and how it works. As you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, this is one of the most complex, if not the most complex, of the tax regimes out there for oil and gas, and we've really done the best we can to try and boil it down to something understandable. The presentation is not about policy. It's about making sure that we communicate a solid understanding of how the current system works. So I will start by looking at all the sources of oil and gas revenue that the state receives, and then we will move on to a detailed walkthrough of the production tax and each step of the production tax calculation. The focus is on the North Slope, as that's the main revenue source to the state. And we're going to walk, in terms of oil revenue, we'll walk through the fiscal year 2022 forecast for production tax, and then at the end we'll have a five-year overview that looks at fiscal years 19 through fiscal year 2023, so 2 years of history, the current year, and then 2 years of forecast. Slide Slide 4 is a disclaimer as we go through the presentation. This analysis attempts to take a very complex tax system and break it down into understandable pieces, so there is some simplification in the analysis. The analysis is based on aggregated data and our forecasted estimates for various components of the production tax. And as a general disclaimer, I'm an economist, not an auditor, so anything that I say is not an official tax interpretation. It's a walkthrough of the revenue forecast that we prepare to illustrate the tax calculation.
Go ahead and continue.
Sure. So slide 5 is an overview of the primary oil and gas revenue sources. There are 4 revenue sources. Royalty is received for production from state land. We also get a portion of shared royalty for production on federal land. The corporate income tax is based on worldwide income, which is apportioned to Alaska. This applies to many but not all of the companies operating in Alaska. The oil and gas property tax applies to all property anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit. And then the production tax, which is the state's severance tax on oil and gas, applies to all production anywhere in the state, regardless of landowner, and any production within the state's 3-mile limit. Not all oil is the same, and we have a slide towards the end of the presentation that looks at how these different taxes and royalties apply to each different category of land in the state.
Do we have any questions on this slide, Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the corporate income tax, it says 9.4% is the top rate. What's the average, or what is the total corporate income tax that's paid? Do you know, is it 9.4% or is it somewhat less for the North Slope?
Sure, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the 9.4% is the marginal tax rate. In terms of the effective tax rate that companies pay, some companies end up paying more than 9.4%. Some companies end up paying less than 9.4%. The average across the slope is a little bit less than 9.4% in aggregate. But again, some companies pay more than that. Some companies pay less.
Senator Wilikowski.
Is that 9.4% of what, the profits, the net profits? Gross value of production, what?
Sure. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So the question is, what does the corporate income tax marginal rate apply to? And the answer is that applies to Alaska taxable income. The way that income is determined is by looking at a company's modified worldwide income and then apportioning that to Alaska based on an apportionment factor that is Alaska's share of production, property, and sales and tariffs of those items in Alaska compared to worldwide. And then that worldwide income is apportioned to Alaska to determine Alaska taxable income. That's what the corporate income tax rate is applied to.
Well, what?
Does that allow the corporations to write off expenses that occur outside of Alaska?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, in determining the worldwide net income, that would incorporate expenses anywhere in the world. Similarly, Alaska expenses would be incorporated into the net income that's determined for corporate income taxes at a federal level and in other states.
And a follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
Has there been any analysis over the years of how much going from separate accounting to worldwide apportionment has cost or made the state?
If you could, Mr. Stickle, to help us with that, there's two different issues here that embedded in Senator Wilikowski's question. One of them is the current process, I think, since Hammond administration using proportional accounting versus separate accounting. So maybe you could help by first defining the separate accounting and how it's different from proportional accounting, and that might put the foundation down to help answer Senator Wilkowski's question.
Sure. I'll take a stab at that, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So there are two methodologies for corporate income tax that have been used in Alaska in the past. The methodology of apportionable income is the methodology that is widely used across the United States for corporate income taxes in various states. And that methodology starts with a federal taxable income with some modifications, and then uses that federal income tax return as kind of the starting point to determine a state taxable income using these apportionment factors. That is the current law. In the past, Alaska has also used what's known as separate accounting. What that does is attempt to account for revenues and expenditures just in Alaska and calculate the tax off of that. And to the question of have we done analysis of the potential impacts of apportionment versus separate accounting, the answer is yes, we have done analysis of that. I don't have that in front of me.
I think we'll be having that in front of the committee later on if there's a corporate income tax bill. Senator Wilkowski.
Could I request a copy of that document, Mr. Chairman, the analysis of between worldwide apportionment and separate accounting, how much it would have cost or earned the state over since Governor Hammond, I guess, switched.
Correct. Mr. Stickle, if you could help the committee with any information on the analysis on that subject matter, we will be looking at that, I'm sure, later on. So it wouldn't hurt to get a head start on that subject matter. I think we've had some of that stuff reviewed over the years as we've had the discussion on taxes. Also, I think it might be nice to have a clarification, Mr. Stickle, on the corporate income tax deductions within the oil basin and how those deductions, amortization, depreciation, or what have you, affects or does not affect our production tax calculation. In particular, there's always been questions on depreciation, amortization. Can you help clarify that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So we do have some information on corporate income tax, which we'll be happy to provide as a response or bring before the committee in a future presentation. In terms of production tax expenditures, we do not have depreciation for production tax. That we do have depreciation for corporate income tax, and that's something that we'll get into a little bit in future slides.
I should have clarified my question and put it more on point. Both taxes deduct operating and capital expenditures, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Right. So there is some crossover, and it's just nice to keep that clear. I know it gets confusing sometimes, and some people think you're, you know, double deducting, which you're not really doing. They're two separate structures completely for separate purposes. So we have a question from Senator Wilson.
I'll defer, Mr. Chair, if we're going to have another presentation on the oil income tax structure or presentation. I can wait till then.
Okay. I'm sure it's coming. I think from what I heard, there's a potential bill coming, and I've asked some of the departments to start preparing for that. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You note that only C corporations pay the corporate income tax. How many non-C corporations, I guess the other alternative would be an S corporation, but correct me if I'm wrong if there are others, but how many S corporations or other non-C corporations are on the North Slope currently, and how much tax revenue are we losing or are we not collecting if these corporations had been incorporated as C corporations?
If you could help us with a brief outline of that, I think that's a whole separate discussion when we get into the tax legislation that may be coming before this committee, but Mr. Stickle, if you could help us, give us an idea how many Chapter C corporations, Subchapter S, and roughly number of companies and aggregate dollar balance between the two, weighting if it's two-thirds to one-third or three-quarters to, you know, one-quarter. Can you help us with that?
Sure, Mr. Chairman and Senator Wilkowski through the chair. The question has to do with the relative proportion of C corporations and non-C corporations. And this question is important because the corporate income tax applies to C corporations. Under federal tax law, there are other types of corporations that are considered pass-through entities for income tax purposes, where those entities don't pay a corporate tax, but instead pass through income to the individuals. A subchapter S corporation and a partnership are two examples of pass-through entities. And since Alaska does not have a personal income tax, we do not tax those entities at the state level. In terms of the, I don't have numbers of individual companies, for fiscal year 22, approximately 70% of production is estimated to come from C corporations, and approximately 30% of production is estimated to come from non-C corporations, which would be pass-through entities.
So, Mr. Strick,
and I think...
No, just go ahead. Maybe you can put some further analysis into that, so we can go into more detail in upcoming meetings when we have that issue in front of us. So I didn't mean to cut you off, so go ahead and finish your statement, please.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to offer that if a bill to address this comes before the committee, we'd be happy to provide additional analysis and a revenue estimate. Okay.
And also, I'm sure we'll be looking again at a look-back provision on separate accounting versus proportional accounting. We've done that over the past, too, so some of this stuff's pretty standard. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just a request, Mr. Chair. If the statement was made that if a bill comes before the committee, I don't know if a bill's coming before the committee or not, but I'd like to see that analysis of C-corps versus S-corps, regardless, personally.
That's fine. We can have that delivered early. I don't think that'll be that's no issue at all. We have other questions on slide number 5. Okay, go ahead and we'll go on to slide number 6. Let me just stop there for a second, just for those watching at home, why it's significant. The corporate tax issue is one of four component parts: royalties, corporate tax, property tax, and production tax. That is used in looking at the split of profit oil or sharing in the profits with the state or the sovereign. So was one of those, any of those four component parts change, it makes a difference in the sharing relationship and the balance of the fiscal structure. Sometimes it may go in favor of the state, sometimes it may go in favor of the industry. But either way, it moves cash on the table, net cash, and we are seeing significant movements the last several years. So the Finance Committee needs to be up to speed on the magnitude and direction of those movements. We have other question on 5 before we go to 6. Page 6.
Sure. So continuing on, slide 6 puts numbers to these revenue sources and shows all sources of state revenue from oil and gas for fiscal year 2019 through 2023, as well as the oil price and Alaska North Slope oil production volumes that went into those numbers. The property tax here is the state share only. There's also several hundred million dollars of oil and gas property tax that accrues to municipalities. The corporate income tax, which we've been discussing, it does apply to C corporations only. There's some temporary impacts there for fiscal years 20 through 22 that have to do with low oil prices and federal law changes, as we discussed a few weeks ago in our fall forecast presentation to the committee. And then the production tax, which is the focus of the presentation here today, and we'll get into some more detail on that in coming slides. The royalties line here includes bonuses, rents, and related interest. It also includes the share of royalties that go to the permanent fund and the school fund. There are settlements to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. These are based on assessments or disputes regarding past year's production tax royalty or other oil and gas or minerals taxes, and under the state constitution, the revenues from settling those assessments or disputes are deposited to the Budget Reserve Fund. And then finally, National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, NPRA, shared revenue. 50% of any federal royalties from the NPRA are shared with the state, but there's special restrictions around how those revenues have to be used. This will become a bigger piece of the revenue picture beyond the time horizon of this slide, but this line item is forecasted to grow to $94 million by fiscal year 2030 with increased production in the NPRA.
Senator Wilson and Senator Wilkowski.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stigall, can you explain sort of the impact that COVID may have had on the oil and gas industry in Alaska in terms of production or federal regulatorial or state regulatorial changes that may affect the forecasts in the next few years?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, the question is about the impact of COVID on the oil and gas industry in the state. I would say the impact was very significant in 2020. We saw an unprecedented drop in oil price, and Alaska North Slope oil prices actually went below zero for a day in April of 2020. The combination of the low price and difficulty in figuring out how to manage operations through the COVID situation led several companies to suspend activities and even reduce production. At this point, prices have rebounded and production has rebounded as well, but I think the impact on the industry in 2020 and going forward as they're continuing to have to manage their operations through COVID, it's been significant.
Follow-up?
I guess as a follow-up, is there any federal changes in the corporate tax structure that also may impact Alaska's future financial standing with some of these companies?
Sure. Senator Wilson, through the chair. So the CARES Act passed at the federal level, which was a COVID relief package. It did include some changes to the corporate income tax, which allows companies to take net operating losses in calendar year 2018, 2019, or 2020, and it allows companies to carry those losses back up to 5 years and potentially obtain refunds for prior year taxes paid. And these so-called CARES Act-related refunds are incorporated into our corporate income tax forecast for fiscal year 2021 and 2022.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Murkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the provision you just spoke of, the CARES Act, net operating loss write-offs, are the companies allowed to write off their net losses on their state taxes plus their federal taxes? In other words, do they get a double write-off?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm not entirely sure I follow the question, but any net operating loss would be based on worldwide net income as apportioned to Alaska, as we've discussed previously.
So if a company has a net operating loss, then they're having the ability to write it off on their federal taxes pursuant to the CARES Act, and then because our state law is tied to federal taxes, they get to write it off again on their state taxes. Is that, am I understanding that correct?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, so a company would be able to, if a company has a net operating loss in one of these 3 years, they would be able to claim, potentially claim refunds for prior year taxes paid at both the state and the federal level.
Good. And have the, has the state been actually writing checks to the companies for to refund them for these net operating losses? And if so, how much?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I do not have the answer to that question. One of my colleagues may, or we could get back to the committee.
You can get back to the committee and with the Department of Revenue, we can find out. We've touched on that before, as far as how much is actually a check being written, and some of them are just not written. They're just a deduct paperwork. But I think the question is, there's about a $60 million swing, not a $20 million swing, in the oil and gas basin. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So for the oil and gas corporate income tax, we're estimating an impact of about $6.6 million for fiscal year 21 and about $62.9 million for fiscal year 2022 under the fall forecast.
Okay.
And so that has a net impact across the 2 years of about a little under $70 million of revenue impact.
Okay.
And then the $20 million is for fiscal year 2022 in the forecast. That's the net result of, you know, what would have been a positive revenue to the tune of about $40 million.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. What is the what's the break even price for companies that are producing oil at Prudhoe Bay?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, don't have a field specific number handy. We'd be happy to calculate something and provide that to the committee.
If I can,
I think we'll look at that when we look at the different price scenarios, 40 to 80 or whatever the committee wants to look at. We'll be looking at some of that stuff going forward.
And just to clarify, thank you. Just to clarify the request, if we could get a break even for, I guess, the legacy fields, Prudhoe, Kopark, and Alpine. In other words, that how much the price of oil needs to be for the industry to make break even.
So if you can give us what you can on a break even analysis north of 68 and break it down as in as many component parts as you can, would be nice. I think that's what you're asking.
Yes.
I think we'll run into the same thing we've run into the past. We end up with aggregate numbers. We can't even bifurcate out Point Thompson. Senator Wilkowski.
And then just back on the NOLs, does the department consider a net operating loss a credit, or even if a refund of, go ahead, I guess that's my question. Does the department consider a net operating loss a credit?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, to go back to the prior question about the break-even price, for the major producers on the slope, that break-even price is around $35 per barrel. Of course, that value is going to vary for each individual producer and which year you're looking at. And as we get later into the presentation, we'll definitely see how, individual producers have very different situation and different economics in the state. To the most recent question of, is the net operating loss considered a credit? The answer would be no.
Okay. But let's be careful when we use the word credit. It can be used from multiple angles. Sometimes there are credits right against your tax that you'd pay, and sometimes they're used embedded in a calculation further up the line. So we need to be a little careful when we throw the term around the table. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just back on that break-even price, you said it was $35. The question I'm asking is the break-even price at each individual legacy field. Is that what it is at Prudhoe Bay, for example, $35? Or is that across the entire North Slope?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, again, I believe that that's an aggregate number across several of the fields, and sounds like we still get to follow up with some more detail on, around that number.
Yeah, if you could follow up, we've also asked the department to work on some different price ranges, and so we can see these cost factors move, and that'll be in future hearings. So if you could give the committee a breakdown as well as you can, we're very aware that you can't give us Prudhoe and Kaparik separately or Point Thompson separately. Give us what you can with the definition of why you can't go further. I think there's some statutory requirements that you have to meet and confidentiality requirements. So Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. So if the break-even price was $35 a barrel, then in 2019 oil was $69.46, and 2020 it was $52.12, and 2021 it was $45.32. So even at am I understanding that correctly? Even in 2021, the lowest point, there was still a $10.32 profit per barrel.
Well, I think we're just getting way late here. Let's get back on track. After we walk through the order of operations so people can understand how we get to the bottom line, then we can go back and look at different years. But we're just working at 30,000-foot level. There's a lot of component parts that come into play. So when we get down through the order of operation, we can go in and look at 20, 21, and 22 that's in the book or any other previous years the committee would like. But I want to keep moving here. Senator Wilson, anybody else have a question? The questions that Senator Wilikowski is asking, some of them are on point, but we need to put them on point in the proper order in the presentation, so it makes sense and people at home can follow the conclusions. So we'll go on to page 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we will be following up with the committee to provide a little bit more context around those numbers that we were discussing. Slide 7 shows the overall order in which the elements of the oil and gas fiscal system are applied. Royalties come first, right off the top. Those are based on land ownership. The owners get their share of the resource right off the top before any taxes are calculated. Property tax comes second. State and local property taxes are considered lease expenditures that can be applied against the production tax. And so the production tax is third in this order of operations, and we'll be discussing in detail in the coming slides. Production tax comes after royalties are subtracted, and property tax is an allowable deduction in the production tax. Next is state corporate income tax, which, as we discussed, uses worldwide income as part of the tax base. Property and production taxes are both excluded, taken out from the income calculation for corporate income tax. And then finally, the federal corporate income tax. All state taxes, including the state corporate income tax, are allowable deductions against the federal corporate income tax.
Okay, go on to slide 8.
So slide 8 moves on to the production tax, which is kind of the meat of the presentation here today. This table has a lot going on, so we'll spend the next several slides unpacking it piece by piece. This is based on the income statement for the production tax as presented in Appendix E of the Revenue Sources book. And this slide walks through the illustration of the production tax calculation for fiscal year 2022. We start with Department of Revenue's forecast of average oil prices of $48 per barrel and average daily production of 439.6 thousand barrels per day. And then we calculate the annual number of barrels and the dollar value of that production. And so our focus over the next several slides will be on how that total annual value of $7.7 billion worth of oil produced on the North Slope is split and taxed. A few notes as we go through the presentation. This is an aggregation and an illustration. Actual taxes are based on monthly filings and annual calendar year returns that are then subject to audit. And again, this is just for North Slope oil, which is the largest portion of the state's oil and gas production tax and revenue, to simplify the analysis.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Slide 9, we'll start walking through the income statement. We'll start at the top. The first step is calculating taxable barrels. Any royalty barrels are subtracted regardless of the ownership of those barrels. Typical royalty rates are 1/8 or 1/6, but rates do vary. Federal and private land royalty is also subtracted here. And also we subtract barrels that are not subject to tax due to being in federal waters. Currently, this is a small portion of North Star production. Production from the Liberty Field would also fall into this category. And so after subtracting those royalty and non-taxable barrels, we arrive at taxable barrels, which is estimated at 141 million barrels for a total value of $6.8 billion.
Okay. Any questions on that? Years ago, the committee even had trouble getting that number, back 15 years ago, so we've made a lot of progress over the time. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickel, under the royalty and other federal barrels, is Alaska's royalty in kind of inside there, the oil that we then sell to the refineries?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, yes. Yeah. So the royalty includes both royalty in kind as well as royalty in value.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Moving on to slide 10, which is the second step, the calculation of gross value at point of production. This is a term used widely in production tax and royalty, also referred to as the wellhead value. You'll see those two terms used interchangeably. Transportation costs are deducted from the taxable value to determine the gross value at point of production. These transportation costs are also known as netback costs. Those are another set of terms that are frequently used interchangeably. So the gross value of point of production starts with the sales price at market and deducts each individual piece of the transportation cost to net back to the wellhead value. We start with the oil sale. The $48 is on the West Coast. Typically Long Beach or Anacortes are the major destinations, and then we deduct the various transportation costs, including marine costs, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Tariff, feeder pipeline tariff, and quality bank, to get to an average wellhead value of $38.09 per barrel, estimated for fiscal year 2022, which gets a total gross value at point of production for tax purposes of $5.4 billion.
Okay. On the previous questions on corporate income tax, I'd like the department to take a look at the transportation issue also. I think there might be some federal legislation that would allow transportation cost to artificially increase, thereby increasing that deduction. So I think there's some issues back in Washington on that, and if you could take a look at that for us, because we'll be asking about that when you come before us on the tax issue that's coming. In other words, in English, the concern is we may have a federal policy change that affects transportation deduction costs just like the corporate tax deduction. And the committee would like to be prepared for that in the event that that, in fact, takes place. And for those, again, watching at home, that's the pipeline and the oil tankers in English. Any other questions on transportation costs? Mr. Stickel, could you remind the committee that the cost of transportation and the relationship of that cost with the production volume going down the pipeline, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So the total cost of transportation for fiscal year 2022 is estimated at $9.91 per barrel. Generally speaking, as production volumes decline, that average cost per barrel is going to increase. The reason being that some of the costs of operation, in particular for the pipeline, there's a lot of fixed costs in maintaining those pipelines.
So it's advantageous to us to have more volume down taps so we can get our per barrel transportation cost down, which is currently about $1.4 billion a year. And that's relatively static. Is that correct?
That's generally correct, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Higher production is going to put downward pressure on the per barrel transportation cost.
Right. Okay, any questions on transportation? We'll go ahead and go on now to the operating and capital cost deductions, I guess, on lease expenditures, slide 11.
Sure. So, yeah, slide 11 looks at lease expenditures. The production tax that we use is essentially a modified net profit tax. So companies are allowed to deduct both capital and operating expenditures in calculating their production tax. For capital expenditures, we use IRS guidelines in general to define what is a capital expenditure. However, for production tax, there is no depreciation. Companies get to immediately deduct all capital costs in the year incurred. That's a particular benefit of our production tax. On operating expenditures, these are any allowable expenditures that are not capital expense, things like the ongoing cost of operations, labor, and maintenance.
Two terms to understand
around lease expenditures. We have allowable and deductible lease expenditures. Allowable lease expenditures are generally any cost in the unit that's directly associated with producing oil, but not everything is allowable under the tax code. Examples of non-allowable expenditures include financing costs, lease acquisition costs, costs of resolving disputes, dismantlement, removal, and restoration. Deductible lease expenditures is a term of art that's used solely for presentation purposes. It's not defined in any statute or regulation, but we make use of it in our presentations and modeling. And the deductible lease expenditures are that portion of the allowable lease expenditures that are applied in the tax calculation in the year incurred. Any lease expenditures beyond the deductible lease expenditures are called non-deductible lease expenditures, and those would turn into carry forwards that could potentially be used to offset a future year tax liability.
Okay. Any questions on deductibility and non-deductible ability? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I get a breakdown, or could the committee get a breakdown of the deductible operating expenditures and capital expenditures per field?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we'll see what we can do. One of the issues around these is that the expenditures are calculated at a company level. So the Alaska's production tax is not levied on a field basis. It's levied on a company basis, so it takes into account all of a company's operations across the slope, regardless of, you know, the different fields and investments each individual company is making. But we'll see what we can do.
And if you can give us as much detail as you can, that would be appreciated. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the non-deductible carryovers, the carry-forwards, is there a limit to that they can carry over year for year?
Senator Olson, no, there is not a limit to the amount of lease expenditures that can be earned as a carry-forward. There are some limits in terms of how far into the future a carry-forward can be carried. After the 8th or 11th year, after earned, those carry-forwards do start to lose value over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think we'll be looking at the bottom of the presentation, we'll be looking at carry-forward expenditures. They can be significant. Mm-hmm. We have other questions on this. Just remember, don't get confused, these same operating and capital expenditure deductions on the production sharing or production tax or similar expenditures, or if not the same expenditures used in the corporate income tax. So don't get confused on they're not deducted twice. And my knowledge of the corporate tax structures, you really can't beat the IRS. They never let you deduct anything twice. They don't double dip, but they never miss anything either. So we'll go on to the next slide, please.
So slide 12, step 4 in the calculation. Now we get to the production tax value, or PTV. The PTV is the gross value at point of production, less deductible lease expenditures. It's essentially the measure of net profit that we use for the production tax. Each company calculates its production tax value based on all their North Slope activity, including all fields and investments in new development. And the production tax value is essentially the tax base for the production tax.
Any questions on this? So this is the profit oil we talk about quite a bit. So if you can go ahead and continue.
Moving on to slide 13, there are two parallel tax calculations done side by side, and the final tax is the higher of the minimum tax and the net tax. The minimum tax it's not a true tax levy, it's a tax floor calculation. The minimum tax is 4% of gross value at point of production when annual oil prices are $25 per barrel or more. The minimum tax decreases at oil prices below $25 per barrel. But for fiscal year 2022, the minimum tax was 4% times the gross value of $5.4 billion, or about $215.5 million for the minimum.
Can you go ahead and continue?
All right, moving on to slide 14, just a little bit of detail about the gross value of reduction before we get into the production, the net tax calculation. The gross value reduction, or the GVR, that's an incentive for new development that was put in place in 2013 as part of the Senate Bill 21 tax reform. The GVR is a temporary benefit. It's used to, and it applies to oil from qualifying new fields. The GVR expires after 7 years of production or any 3 years of greater than $70 oil price. And what the GVR does is it excludes 20 or 30% of the gross value from qualifying fields from the calculation of production tax value, effectively reduces the net tax calculation for those fields significantly. And for GVR eligible production, those fields get a flat $5 per barrel taxable production tax credits that can be used to reduce tax below the minimum tax for companies that do not use any sliding scale credit. We'll get into a little bit more detail on those credits in the coming slides.
So are you finished with this slide? You got the last item?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So if I'm hearing you correctly, the 4% floor is a soft floor. We can go below it with a $5 credit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The 4% minimum tax is a floor. It's a tax calculation floor. If a company chooses to use a sliding scale per taxable barrel credit, they cannot pay below that floor. A company may choose to forego the sliding scale credit and use other credits to reduce their tax below the floor. And we have some more information that kind of addresses that in coming slides.
Okay, so if I get ahead of myself, just let me know. We'll pick it up in future slides. So the 20 or 30% gross value reduction, the $5 per credit, is also attributed to those fields that can have a 20 or 30% gross value reduction. Is that correct or incorrect?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The flat $5 per taxable barrel production tax credit applies to the same GBR eligible production that receives the 20 or 30% value reduction.
And can you give us, unless you're going to give it to us later, percentages of the production that can be attributed or we would expect to be attributed to the 20% gross value reduction or the 30% gross value reduction? And then I assume then the rest of it would add up to 100%.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm looking at figure 6-7 of the Fall 2020 Revenue Sources Book. For fiscal year 2021, 8% of oil production is estimated to be eligible for gross value reduction. That number increases to 23% by fiscal year 2027, and then 27% in fiscal year 2028. So as some of these new developments come online, Pikka and Willow and other new developments, the forecasted share of production from GBR-eligible fields does increase.
Could you reference your page you're looking at? I got the book here, and I missed that when you listed off the page number, and I don't have a bookmark, so.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at a figure on page 51 of the Fall 2020 Revenue Sources Book.
Okay. One of the concerns we've had at the committee is all oil is not equal. We'll get into that. And some oil may not generate anything for the state for years and years, and we're concerned about our cash flow. So in the table here, we've got a breakdown then of the GVR eligible fields, but does it split out that percentage as far as what's exposed to the 20% and what would be exposed to the 30%?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that handy. A breakout that we can take a look at and get back to the committee.
Right, if you can get that back to the committee, it'd be appreciated. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if a company is developing in MPRA, then let's say they're spending $1 billion, let's say it's an incumbent producer, ConocoPhillips, for example, they're spending $1 billion a year in MPRA, they're able to write those costs off their production at Prudhoe Park, is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, regardless of which land type it is, if a company has sufficient gross value at point of production, the investments in new production would be considered deductible lease expenditures, yes.
Okay. And if I could
follow up.
And just to sort of make, I guess, the point that the chair regularly says, which is all oil is not equal. Production at NPR is particularly not equal because as companies are developing there, they're writing off that money off their existing fields like Prudhoe Bay, and so that can cost the state, I would guess, probably hundreds of millions of dollars. Then when the field goes into production, we get virtually no royalties, and now under this gross value reduction, we get virtually no taxes either for at least 7 years. Am I stating that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the situation, it's really a situational question. Depends on the company, depends on the price of oil, depends on the relative production and investment in the different fields.
I think what we should do on that question, because I understand what you're getting at, is, Senator Wilkowski, deductions created on areas in the basin where we don't have much revenue source for various reasons, land ownership. We're still exposed to the deduction against our other revenue. I think we could probably get a finer answer through our consultants at LBNA. They can model that stuff for us, the different ownership interests and how that all then comes together. I think, Mr. Stickle, you get us what information the department can on that, but I think we could get probably more in another direction. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, and Mr. Stickle, give us specifics. If you don't want to speak in generalities, give us specifics. How much has, in NPRA, over the last 5 years, how much has the state allowed in tax deductions on existing fields? How much revenue have we gotten, and what's the projection of revenue that we expect to get? Can you give us those particulars? As a policymaker trying to set the right policy, I would like to see that specific information. Can you get it for us?
Well, I think we've talked about that here. Let him answer the question, because sometimes we do it to ourselves. We put it in our own statutes, which blocks us. Another example is Point Thompson, where we have significant expenditures in billions in credits and high tariffs and questionable economics when you look at it as from a business decision of just looking at the dollars. So if you can help the committee, Mr. Stickle, on the information breakdown as much as you can, would be appreciated, and then we can take that further question to our consultants and get a finer point to the question, because it is of concern, as unless there's a big directional change out of Washington underway that gets executed, that's underway, we'll have considerably more production going outside of state-owned land. And we need to know our exposure to our finances from that, both good and bad. Okay, so we can go on to the next page, 15.
Sure. So slide 15 is looking at the calculation of the net production tax. The net tax is based on production tax value times the 35% statutory tax rate. The gross value reduction to the production tax value is shown here. That's only accounting for those companies that have a positive production tax value. So companies with qualifying new production, they get to reduce their gross value point of production for purposes of calculating the production tax value. And then the 35% tax rate is applied to the production tax value after subtracting that GVR. In fiscal year 2022, we're estimating that 35% tax calculation would come out to about $367 million. And then we take the higher of the gross minimum tax floor or the net tax. In this case, the net tax is the higher of, and the $367 million becomes the production tax before credit.
Okay, so that's, this gets down into the confusing part that you have, we need to get used to. You're in the gross arena at lower prices and the net arena at higher prices, and that tipping point changes depending on relationship between volume and expenditures. So we're going to have a sliding scale on that coming up, I think. So any questions on this? Okay, we'll go on to the next page.
All right, I'm on slide 16, moving on to tax credits applied against tax liability. The major credits are the per taxable barrel credits, which are actually two separate credits, one for GVR eligible oil and one for non-GVR oil. The vast majority of oil is non-GVR currently, but as we discussed, that the GVR eligible oil will increase in the future as new fields are coming online. For non-GVR production, there's a sliding scale for taxable barrel credit that ranges from $0 to $8 per barrel of taxable production. The $8 per barrel credit applies when wellhead values are less than $80 per barrel, which is currently the case and expected to be the case over the time horizon of our forecast. These sliding scale credits cannot be used to reduce the tax below the minimum tax, and any company claiming this credit cannot pay below the minimum tax. Again, for the GVR eligible production, there's a flat $5 per taxable barrel production tax credit. This credit, in some instances, can be used to reduce tax below the minimum tax for companies that do not take any sliding scale credit. Any of these per taxable barrel credits are use it or lose it. They cannot be carried forward or refunded. And then other tax credits applied against tax liability include small producer credits plus some prior year credits earned back when the state gave credits for net operating losses, which was pre-2018.
Here we have questions on these credits here. That the in your revenue source book, you're showing, I think, $46 million in credit deductions on 23A, 5523A, and B, which is a bunch of commingled data for us, carry loss forward, I think. How applicable is that? Is that in the category of other credits against liability, that 47.1 number?
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to have to head out to a meeting I've got to go to, but I just the total tax, as it, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but so there's $7.701 billion of oil going down the pipeline. The taxable barrels is $7.68 billion, and the gross value point of production is $5.38 billion. Which is very low by historical, by at least recent standards. We're getting $163.3 million in tax, which if I calculate correct, is 3% of tax at the gross value production, 2.4% of tax at the taxable barrels, and 2.1% tax of the total oil being produced. Alaska's getting, we have a 35% tax rate, but in reality we're getting 3% of the gross value production. And when you add in the royalties, the total tax, and we've got a negative corporate tax, so we're getting 13.9% of the total value of the oil. Have we ever in the history of our state gotten a lower amount for our oil? By my calculation, this is roughly half what we've historically gotten for our oil since the passage of SB 21. Is that correct?
I think that kind of a question is a little too aggressive, but I think the what I'd like you to do is give us, I think we're going to get in, Senator Wilikowski's got to run to another meeting, and we've got some actuals from 19 through forecast of 23 here in a couple of slides. So we'll take a look at that. We'll do the percentages, and we can, on the other presentation that I've been talking to you about working on, when we look at our percentage sharing relationship and over different price scenarios, we'll make sure we go back and have a historical look, Senator Wilikowski, so we can actually see the numerics that you're referring to historically, what they were and what they are currently. So you could, and well, we can all see where we are under different price and volume relationships. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it is aggressive, and I think we're standing here losing probably $1 billion a year. If we had our historical average, if we were getting the historical average for our resource, we'd be getting probably another $1 billion by my calculation, and we've got a $2 billion deficit, and we can't just keep giving this money away, Mr. Chairman. And I would like that analysis done by the department. I've done my own analysis. Others have done an analysis. We can't just afford to keep giving our oil away, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I got to run, but I appreciate the presentation. I appreciate Mr. Stickle being here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and I've asked and worked with the department for several years on this slide to get to the net number for the committee members. But let's not forget this is the production tax. We need to add in royalties, income tax, and property tax. And we'll have all those numbers also in a table format for everybody. And also, we'll be looking at possibly getting some help with our consultants, because the price structure or the capital structure of the industry is changing constantly also. So what appear to be a competitive position at one time may not be competitive at another, and vice versa. So keep an open mind as we work through this. Go on to the next slide, slide 17.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So after the total tax after credit calculation, there's some other items that get added to that to get to the total production tax revenue received by the state in any given fiscal year. These include prior year tax payments or refunds, private landowner royalty tax, hazardous release surcharge, any taxes on natural gas on the slope, as well as total Cook Inlet tax liability, and any additional company-specific details.
So this number then takes this number takes in south of 68, takes into account Cook Inlet also, the 163.3?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The 163.3 is the net tax or the net cash to the state from the production tax for the fiscal year.
Thank you. We have questions on that. And I do appreciate Mr. Stickle, the department, putting this together. I know I've drilled you poor guys for years and worked with you for years on trying to make this as clear as possible to the committee members what the net cash is on the table, so we can count the cash to do our budgets, not money that is just a numeric and doesn't really appear in the end because it gets, delivered somewhere else. So can you help me before you go on to the next slide, the last numeric of this slide, the 562.7, how that may affect us in the future?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So for fiscal year 2022, there's, as you mentioned, the $562.7 million of non-deductible lease expenditures. We expect those to be carried forward by companies that were not able to deduct those costs against production tax value in fiscal year 2022, and they could potentially be applied to reduce future year tax liabilities.
And is that an accumulative, or is that just the annual in this fiscal year? Because I know that rolls forward and accumulates. So can you just clarify that?
Mr. Chairman, that's the amount expected to be earned just in fiscal year 2022.
Okay. And I know you have in your revenue source book the accumulation year after year. So if you could remind the committee what page that's on, because they'll want to reference that.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. On page 76 of the Fall 2020 Revenue Sources Book, which is figure 8.4, we present a value in row 22 of that table for carried forward credits balances and tax value of carried forward annual losses.
And it's projected.
Yeah, the value in this table is the ultimate tax value, which is the amount of the carry forward loss times the 35% net tax rate.
And it's forecasted to go over $1 billion in 2024, $1.1 billion, and approach $1.6 billion in 2030?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Just as a brief note, the industry has to be allowed to deduct their expenditures or their economics will never work. So although these numbers are big and alarming, there's more to that equation. But it is significant, no doubt about it. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to point out again a word that Dan said, and if I'm not accurate, please correct me, Mr. Stickle, but on the new lease expenditures earned and carry forward, that you said potentially they could be deducted in the future. So that's a key word that needs to be, am I right or wrong?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, that's correct. A company would need to have sufficient future production and sufficient future value to apply those lease expenditures.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on to the next slide.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, and just one more comment on slide 17 before we move on. Some folks might look at the $163 million of total production tax and ask, why is that lower than the minimum tax calculation of $215.5 million? And that's because the minimum tax is applied on a company-by-company basis. And in our forecast, we're projecting that at $48 per barrel oil, some companies will choose to forego sliding scale credit and use other credits to reduce their payments below the minimum tax. And that's the reason that the net tax collection is below the aggregate minimum tax.
And I think Senator Stedman asks you that question every single year when you come out with your book. We sit down and go over it. So for clarity, because I think the net number is very important. And we've had difficulty years and years ago getting the net number so we could understand it. And that's quite some time ago, by the way. Can we go on to slide 18, please?
Sure. Slide 18 is the same analysis we've been walking through, but showing a five-year comparison with 2 years of history, the current year, and then two forecast years. In fiscal year 19 and fiscal year 20, some taxpayers did pay above the minimum tax in those years. In fiscal years 21 through 23, generally companies are able to bring production tax down to the minimum tax. And the forecast assumes that at projected oil prices, some companies in all 3 years will choose to forego sliding scale credits and use other credits to pay below the minimum tax. And so this slide kind of concludes the core presentation, and then we have three more slides that shed additional detail on a couple of issues.
Okay, if you could go through that, even though we've got lots of the committee off to other meetings, they still have Finance Committee staff here paying attention for them. So if you could go ahead and continue, we've got about 10 minutes, 15 at the most, Mr. Stickle.
All right, so slide 19 is an update of a slide we prepared last year showing how revenue would be impacted by different levels for the sliding scale per taxable barrel credit. Currently, that's a sliding scale credit of up to $8 per taxable barrel that's allowed in statute. This table shows what the FY 2022 tax calculation would look like assuming different values for the sliding scale credit of $5, $4, or $3 per taxable barrel.
And if you could rerun that then from the $48, if you could run that at 50, 55, and 60 for the committee, it'd be nice. It'd be easy to do, I think, because you've got it all set up. But go ahead and continue.
Absolutely, happy to do that. But at the forecast price, going from $8 to $5 per taxable barrel would increase the estimated production tax from $163 to $180 million. That would increase to $207 million with a $4 per barrel maximum credit and $234 million with a $3 per barrel maximum credit. This is not making any particular policy suggestion. Obviously, changing the credit would have impacts on investment decisions and economics. We're just updating the scenarios that were requested last year.
Correct. Okay, go ahead and continue on to the next slide.
Slide 20 is a new slide we've added this year, and this looks at what the tax calculation would look like if there were only a single taxpayer for the entire North Slope. Currently, as we discussed, some companies pay at or above the minimum tax, while others choose to forego sliding scale credits and reduce their payments below the minimum tax. And so as a result, the fiscal year 2022 production tax forecast is less than the aggregate minimum tax calculation. In this illustration, if there were only one taxpayer, we would expect that they would use sliding scale credits to reduce their tax liability down to the minimum tax, but not below. And then in this illustration, total production tax in the Treasury would be $229 million in fiscal year 2022 compared to $163 million in the official forecast. And the conclusion from this slide is just kind of highlighting the impact of individual company economics on the tax. Each of our taxpayers has a different portfolio of operations in existing fields and a different portfolio of investments that they're making in exploration and development.
So I've asked Mr. Stickel and talked to him for a couple of years at the beginning of every session on how to lay this out for the committee. And the other day I was talking to him about the difficulty in going following down the minimum tax versus the net tax and when they cross over and how do you depict that for the legislature so it's easy to follow. So I asked him to put a slide together that assumes that there's just one taxpayer on the North Slope. And, you know, if it's beneficial to see where some of these deductions plug in, then by all means use it. If not, just ignore it. I'm just trying to make things as clear as we can when we're dealing with, Mr. Stickel said, probably the most complicated tax structure on the planet for an oil basin. So the only people that feel that this structure is straightforward and easy are the people that don't understand it at all. Okay, we'll go on to the final slide, Mr. Stickel. Slide 21.
Sure. And slide 21, we've shown this slide before, but it's a nice refresher. This slide shows how state petroleum revenues vary by land type. The concept here is not all oil is the same. So production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax all apply everywhere in the state except for federal waters that are beyond 3 miles offshore. Regardless of the ownership of those lands, the state taxes apply. The royalty rates vary by ownership. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to walk through each of the land types, or I can leave this as a reference for the committee.
I think it might be nice for a reference sheet when we, at some point in the future, when we get into the discussion and the point that Senator Wilkowski brought up, that there's deductions on some fields where the potential revenue source to the state is lower, just comparing field A to field B. And I think the concern is why then isn't the deductibility different? So we'll, I guess, delve into that in more detail in the future. I have been looking at and working with the department on a future presentation dealing with varying prices and cost structures, but there, I figured there was no time today to get into that. It's another 20 pages. So we'll plug that in the future, and then it'll give you an idea of where our basin revenue-wise looks if oil was $60 or $50 or $40 or what have you. Mr. Stickel, can you then, that was your last slide, you want to finish up and we'll adjourn the meeting.
Mr. Chairman, those are all the slides I had to present today. I got a little bit of a to-do list to get back to the committee, and thanks again for the opportunity today.
Okay, well, thank you for helping again and redoing this presentation. I think we have you come here every year and do it. Every year it's a good reminder. You do this year all year long. We do it just a few months, so it gets... We need a reminder from time to time as things change. So, and I'll get with the department and yourself on the future presentation, and we'll get that plugged in, and we'll get the committee, when we get the answers to the questions from the department, we'll get it to all committee members. Feel free if you have questions and to get a hold of the department and clarify or what have you. So that concludes the meeting today. 9 a.m. tomorrow, or 9 a.m. Monday morning, not tomorrow, Monday morning, 9 a.m., we have pending referral, Senate Bill 56, extending the COVID-19 disaster emergency. Co-Chair Bishop will be reviewing that bill with the committee, 9 a.m. Monday morning. We are adjourned.